Chapter 50. The taxi passed through a back gate of the Washington National Airport at precisely 9:30 p.m. and dropped Jarvis behind a solitary hangar that sat on a seldom-used end of the field. Except for a faint glow of light through the dusty glass of a side door, the giant building seemed bleak and cavernous. He pushed open the door and was mildly surprised not to hear it creak. The well-oiled hinges pivoted without a whisper. The yawning interior was brilliantly illuminated by overhead fluorescent lighting. A venerable old Ford trimotor aircraft sat like a huge goose in the center of the concrete floor, its wings protectively reaching out over several antique automobiles in various stages of restoration. Jarvis walked over to a car that seemed no more than a pile of rusted iron. A pair of feet protruded from beneath the radiator. "You are Mr. Pitt?" Jarvis inquired. "And you are Mr. Jarvis?" "Yes." Pitt rolled from under the car and sat up. "I see you found my humble abode all right." Jarvis hesitated, taking in Pitt's greasy coveralls and disheveled appearance. "You live here?" "I have an apartment upstairs," Pitt said, pointing to a glass-enclosed level above the hangar floor. "You have a nice collection," said Jarvis, gesturing at the relics. "What is the one over there with the black fenders and silver coachwork?" "A 1936 Maybach Zeppelin town car," Pitt answered. "And the one you're working on?" "A 1912 Renault open-drive landaulette." "Seems a bit the worse for wear," said Jarvis, wiping a finger through a layer of rust. Pitt smiled patiently. "She doesn't really look all that bad when you consider she's been immersed in the sea for 70 years. Jarvis understood immediately. "From the Titanic?" "Yes. I was allowed to keep her after the salvage project. Sort of a prize for services rendered, so to speak." Pitt led the way up a flight of stairs to his apartment. Jarvis entered, and his professional eye routinely traveled over the unusual furnishings. The occupant was a well-traveled man, he surmised, judging from the nautical objects decorating the interior. Copper divers' helmets from another age. Mariners' compasses. Wooden helms. Ship's bells. Even old nails and bottles, all neatly labeled with the names of famous ships from which Pitt had salvaged them. It was like looking into a museum of a man's life. Jarvis sank into a leather sofa at Pitt's invitation. He looked his host directly in the eyes. "Do you know me, Mr. Pitt?" "No." "Yet you had no qualms about seeing me." "Who can resist intrigue?" Pitt said, grinning. "It's not every day I find a note on my windshield with a phone number that turns out to be the National Security Agency." "You guessed, of course, that you were being followed." Pitt reclined in a leather chair and propped his feet on an ottoman. "Let's sack the wordplay, Mr. Jarvis, and get to the point. What's your sport?"
"Sport?"
"Your interest in me." "Okay, Mr. Pitt," said Jarvis. "Cards on the table. What is the real purpose behind NUMA's search for a special type of heavy naval shell?" "Sure you wouldn't like a drink?" Pitt countered. "No, thanks," Jarvis answered, appraising Pitt's casual stall. "If you know we're in the market, then you know why." "Seismological tests on coral formations?" Pitt nodded. Jarvis stretched his arms out on the sofa's backrest. "When do you have the tests scheduled?"
"The last 2 weeks of March next year."
"I see." Jarvis gave Pitt a benign, fatherly look and then lunged for the heart. "I've talked to 4 seismologists, 2 from your own agency. They do not subscribe to your idea of dropping 16-inch naval shells from an airplane. In fact, they found it downright ludicrous. I was also informed that there are no seismographic tests scheduled by NUMA in the Pacific. In short, Mr. Pitt, your clever little dodge won't hold water." Pitt closed his eyes in thought. He could lie or simply offer no comment. No, he reasoned, his alternatives had narrowed down to 0. There was virtually no hope that he and Steiger and Sandecker could negotiate a quick return of the QD warheads from the AAR. They had carried the search as far as their limited resources could take them. The time had come, he decided, to call in the professionals. He opened his eyes and stared at Jarvis.
If it were within my power to place in the palm of your hand a plague organism that could kill without interruption for 300 years, what would you do with it? Pitt's question caught Jarvis off guard. I don't know what you're driving at. The question stands, said Pitt. Is it a weapon? Pitt nodded. An uneasy feeling gripped Jarvis. I know of no such weapon. Chemical and biological arms were effectively and unconditionally banned by every member of the United Nations 10 years ago. Please answer the question, Pitt said. Turn it over to our government, I suppose. Are you certain that's the correct course? Good God, man, what do you want? The case is purely hypothetical. Such a weapon must be destroyed, said Pitt. His green eyes seemed to burn into the back of Jarvis's brain. There was a short silence. Then Jarvis said, Does one truly exist? It does. The pieces were falling into place, and for the first time in all the years he could remember, Jarvis wished he hadn't been so damned efficient. He looked at Pitt and smiled thinly. I'll have that drink now, he said quietly. And then I think you and I should exchange some very disturbing news. It was past midnight when Phil Sawyer stopped the car in front of Lauren's apartment building. He was what most women thought a handsome man, with a solid face and a neatly styled mass of prematurely gray hair. Lauren flashed a provocative expression at him. Would you like to open my apartment door for me? The lock always seems to stick. He smiled. How can I refuse? They got out of the car and strolled through the garden entrance in silence. The sidewalk was wet and reflected the glow from the streetlights. Lauren nestled against his body as the cold drizzle attacked their hair and clothes. The doorman greeted them and held the elevator open. At her door, she fished in her purse and handed Sawyer the key. He turned the lock and they entered. Fix yourself a drink, she said, shaking out her damp hair. I'll be back in a minute. Lauren slipped into the bedroom and Sawyer went over to a small portable bar and poured himself a cognac. He was on his second when Lauren came back into the room. She was wearing pajamas with a silvery gray wrap top and pants that were lace-edged. As she came through the doorway, the light from the bedroom silhouetted her lithe figure through the vaporous nylon. The combination of the pajamas, her cinnamon hair, and her violet eyes suddenly made Sawyer feel like a confused adolescent. You look ravishing, he managed to say. Thank you. She poured a Galliano for herself and sat down next to him on the couch. It was a lovely dinner, Phil. My pleasure. She moved closer and lightly caressed his hand. You seem different tonight. I've never known you to be so relaxed. Not once did you mention the president. 6 weeks and 3 days from now, the new president-elect takes the oath, and my 8-year battle with the gentlemen and ladies of the news media comes to an end. God, I never thought I would feel good about being part of a lame duck administration. What are your plans after the inauguration? My boss has the right idea. As soon as he turns over the reins of office, he's sailing a 40-foot ketch to the South Pacific, where he says he's going to drink and screw himself to death. Sawyer lowered his glass and stared into Lauren's eyes. Now me, I prefer the Caribbean, particularly for a honeymoon. An edge of anticipation began to form inside Lauren. Anyone special in mind? Sawyer set down their glasses and took Lauren's hands in his. Congresswoman Smith, he said with mock seriousness, I respectfully implore you to cast your vote in favor of marriage to Phil Sawyer. Lauren's eyes grew somber and thoughtful. Though she'd been sure this moment would eventually come, she was still uncertain of her answer. Sawyer misread Lauren's hesitancy. I know what's going through your mind, he said gently. You're wondering what life would be like with an unemployed presidential press secretary, right? Well, rest your fears. I have it on good authority the party leaders want me to run for senator from my home state in the next election. In that case, she said resolutely. The eyes have it. Sawyer did not see the uneasiness in Lauren's eyes. He took her head in his hands and gently kissed her on the lips. The room seemed to blur, and the female scent that emanated from her body closed over him. He felt strangely at peace as he buried his face in her breasts. Afterward, when Sawyer lay spent and asleep, Lauren's tears stained the pillow. She had tried desperately with all her soul. She had loved hard, even forcing the expected animal sounds from her throat. But nothing worked. Throughout their violent lovemaking, she found herself comparing Sawyer to Pitt. There was no way of logically explaining the difference. They both felt the same inside her, and yet Pitt turned her into a savage, demanding animal, whereas Sawyer left her empty and unfulfilled. She pressed the pillow against her face to muffle the sobs. "Damn you, Dirk Pitt," she said silently. "Damn you to hell." "I'm not sure whose story comes off the craziest," Pitt said. "Yours or mine?" Jarvis shrugged. "Who can say? The horror is that it's just possible your quick-death warheads and my Operation Wild Rose might prove a match. An attack on a major coastal city with a battleship by South African blacks posing as terrorists of the AAR, it's lunacy." "Wrong," said Jarvis. "The plan smacks of genius. A few bombs placed here or there, or another skyjacking, would hardly move an entire nation to see red. But an old battleship with flags flying, raining explosives on a helpless population, that's sensationalism at its best." "What city?" "None was specified. That part of the plan remains a mystery. Fortunately, the prime ingredient is missing." "A battleship," Jarvis said. "You said they've all been removed from active status." "The last one was sold for scrap months ago. All the rest are non-operational memorials." Pitt stared off into space for a moment. "I recall seeing a capital ship docked on an inlet in Chesapeake Bay only a few weeks ago." "More than likely a heavy missile cruiser," said Jarvis. "No, I'm certain it had three massive gun turrets," Pitt said firmly. "I was on a flight to Savannah, and the plane flew right over it before turning south." Jarvis remained unconvinced. "I have no reason to doubt the accuracy of my information. However, in the interest of security, I'll have your sighting checked out." "There is something else," Pitt said, rising from the chair and searching a row of encyclopedias on a bookshelf. He pulled out a black-bound volume and flipped the pages. "Did you trigger another memory?" asked Jarvis. "Operation Wild Rose," answered Pitt. "What about it?" "The name. Can it stand for anything?" "Code names seldom have an ulterior meaning," said Jarvis. "It might give them away." "I'll bet you a vintage bottle of wine this one does." Pitt held out the book. The pages were open at a map. Jarvis slipped on his reading glasses and took a cursory glance at it. "All right, so Iowa is the Hawkeye State. So what?" Pitt pointed to a spot halfway down the right-hand page. "The state flower of Iowa," he said softly, "is the wild rose." The color abruptly washed from Jarvis's face. "But the battleship Iowa was scrapped." "Scrapped or sold for scrap," said Pitt. "There's a big difference." A series of worry lines grew on Jarvis's forehead. Pitt looked at Jarvis and let the worry lengthen. "If I were you, I'd run a check on all shipyards located on the western Chesapeake shoreline of Maryland." "Your phone." It was more a command than a request. Pitt silently pointed to one on an end table. Jarvis dialed a number. Then, as he waited for an answer, he looked at Pitt. "Do you have a car that isn't an antique?" "I have a Pneuma car parked outside." "I came in a taxi," said Jarvis. "Will you do the honors?" "Give me a minute to clean up," Pitt replied. When Pitt emerged from the bathroom, Jarvis was waiting at the door. "You were right," he said evenly. "As of yesterday, the battleship Iowa was docked at the Forbes Marine Scrap and Salvage Yard in Maryland." "I know the facility," said Pitt. "It's a few miles below the bay entrance to the Patuxent River."